lives which his own life had left behind. His wrinkled hand rose, shaking, to touch at his half-moon glasses. The boy poked his head back in.
Would you mind switching on the stairs, Headmaster? I'd rather not go through all the work again to leave the same way I came.
Go, Harry Potter,
the old wizard said.
The stairs will receive you.
Some time later, an earlier version of Harry, who had invisibly waited next to the gargoyle since 9 p.m., followed the deputy headmistress through the opening that parted for her, stood quietly behind her on the turning stairs until they came to the top, and then, still under the cloak, spun his time-turner thrice. Aftermath, Professor Quirrell and... In a shadowy clearing, the defense professor waited. His back leaned negligently against the rough grey bark of a towering beech tree as yet unleaved in the late March days, so that its trunk and crown seemed like a pale arm reaching up from the ground and exploding into a hand of 1,000 fingers. Around the defense professor and above him were branches so dense that even in the earliest spring, with a few trees so much as budding, you could have hardly seen the sky from the ground. The strands of the wooden net crossed and proliferated so many times that if you were on a broomstick above, searching for someone below, you would have found it easier to follow your ears than your eyes. Nor would it have helped that it was almost dark amid the prohibited woods, the unseen sun almost set, so that only a few glows of fading sunlight illuminated the tops of the tallest trees. Then came the faintest sound of footsteps, almost inaudible even on the forest ground, the gait of a man accustomed to passing unseen. No twig snapped, nor leaf rustled.
"Good afternoon," said Professor Quirrell.
The defense professor did not trouble to move his eyes, or his hands from where they rested negligently at his side. A figure, clad in a black cloak, shimmered into existence, his head turning to look left, and then right. In the figure's right hand, gripped low, was a wand of wood so grey it was almost silver.
"I do not know why you wish to meet here, of all places," said Severus Snape, his voice cool.
"Oh,"
Professor Quirrell said idly, as though the whole matter was of the least importance.
"I thought you would prefer privacy. The walls of Hogwarts have ears, and you would not wish the headmaster to know of your role in yesterday's affair, would you?"
The March chill seemed to grow deeper, the temperature further fall.
"I don't know what you're talking about,"
the potions master said icily.
"You know perfectly well what we are talking about," said Professor Quirrell in an amused voice. "Really, my good professor, you should not meddle in the affairs of idiots unless you are ready to defend yourself upon the instant from all their violence."
The defense professor's hands still lay relaxed and open at his side.
"And yet none of those idiots seem to remember the sight of you falling, nor do the young ladies recall your presence, which raises the fascinating question of why you would go to the extraordinary length, I dare say the desperate length, of casting 52 memory charms."
Professor Quirrell tilted his head.
"Would you fear so much the opinions of mere students? I think not. Would you dread the matter becoming known to your good friend, Lord Malfoy? But those fools upon the very spot invited a quite satisfactory excuse for your presence. No, there is only one person who holds so much power over you, and who would be most perturbed to find you executing a plot without his knowledge. Your true and hidden master, Albus Dumbledore.
What? Hissed the potions master, the anger plain upon his face.
But now, it seems, you're moving on your own. And so I find myself most intrigued as to what you could possibly be doing, and why.
The defense professor regarded the black-clad silhouette of the potions master with the scrutiny a man might give an exceptionally interesting bug, even if it was still ultimately just a bug.
I am no servant of Dumbledore's, the potion master said coldly.
Really? What astonishing news!
The defense professor smiled lightly.
Do tell me all about it.
There was a long pause. From some tree, an owl hooted, the sound huge in the silence. Neither man startled or flinched.
You don't want me as your enemy, Quirrell,
Severus Snape said, his voice very soft.
I don't, said Professor Quirrell. How would you know?
On the other hand,
the potions master continued, voice still soft,
my friends enjoy many advantages.
The man leaning against the grey bark raised his eyebrows.
Such as?
There is much that I know of this school, said the potions master. Things you might not think I knew.
There was an expectant pause.
How incredibly fascinating, said Professor Quirrell.
The man was examining his fingernails with a bored look.
Do go on.
I know you have been investigating the third floor corridor.
You know nothing of the sort.
The man's back straightened against the wood.
Do not bluff against me, Severus Snape. I find it annoying, and you are in no position to annoy me. A single glance would tell any competent wizard that the headmaster has laced that corridor with a ridiculous quantity of wards and webs, triggers and trap signs. And more, there are charms laid there of ancient power, magical constructs of which I have heard not even rumours, techniques that must have been disgorged from the hoarded lore of Flamel himself. Even he who must not be named would have had trouble passing those without notice.
Professor Quirrell tapped a thoughtful finger on his cheek.
And for the actual lock, a colloportus laid on an ordinary doorknob, cast so weakly that it could not have kept out Miss Granger on the day she entered Hogwarts. Never before in my existence have I encountered such a blatant trap.
Now the defense professor narrowed his eyes.
I know of no one left in the world against whom such fantastic feats of detection would serve any useful purpose. If there is some wizard possessed of ancient lore, of whom I know nothing, against whom this trap is set, you may trade that information for as much silence as you like, my dear professor, and a good serving of my favour left over afterward.
You could have sworn that Professor Quirrell was watching Severus Snape with keen interest. Not the faintest trace of a smile crossed the man's lips. There was another long silence in the clearing.
"I do not know who Dumbledore fears," Snape said. "But I know what bait he has set out, and somewhat of how it is truly guarded."
"As to that," said Professor Quirrell, sounding bored again, "I stole it months ago and left a fake in its place, but thank you kindly for asking."
"You're lying," said Severus Snape after a pause.
"Yes, I am."
Professor Quirrell leaned back against the grey wood again, his eyes drifting up to the dense net of branches, the falling night scarcely visible between the complex crossings.
"I simply wished to learn whether you would call me on it, since you are pretending to know so little."
The defense professor smiled to himself. The potions master looked like he was about to choke on his own fury.
"What do you want?"
"Nothing, really,"
said the defense professor, continuing to gaze at the forest ceiling.
"I was only curious. I suppose I shall just watch and see where your plotting goes, and meanwhile I will say nothing to the headmaster. So long, as you are willing to do me a favour, now and then, of course."
A dry smile crossed the face.
"You are dismissed for now, Severus Snape, though I wouldn't mind having another little chat soon, if you are willing to speak with me honestly of where your loyalties lie. And I do mean honestly, not the false faces you've shown today. You might find you have more allies than you thought. Take some time to think it over, my friend."
Aftermath. Draco Malfoy and...
A rainbow hemisphere. A dome of solid force with little chromaticity of its own, which sent back the infringing light in splintered reflections, iridescent in many colours, as it fractured the shine of the many splendid chandeliers of the Slytherin common room. Sheltered beneath the rainbow hemisphere, the terrified face of a young witch who had never fought bullies, who had not joined any of Professor Quirrell's armies, who was getting acceptable marks at best in her defense class, who could not have cast a prismatic barrier even to save her own life.
"Oh, stop it,"
said Draco Malfoy, making his voice sound bored despite the sweat that had broken out underneath his robes, as he kept his wand pointed at the barrier that was sheltering Millicent Bulstrode. He couldn't remember making the decision. There'd just been the two older boys about to hex Millicent, the common room silently staring, and then Draco's hand had just drawn his wand and cast the barrier, leaving his heart to pump itself full of shocked adrenaline while his poor, sad brain frantically racked itself for explanations. The two older boys were straightening up from where they'd been looming over Millicent, turning to Draco, looking at him with a mixture of shock and anger. Gregory and Vincent beside him had already drawn their own wands, but weren't pointing them. All three of them together couldn't have won anyway. But the older boys wouldn't hex him. Nobody could possibly be stupid enough to hex the next Lord Malfoy. It wasn't fear of being hexed that was making Draco sweat beneath his robes, as he desperately hoped the beads of water weren't visible on his forehead. Draco was sweating because of the dawning and sickening certainty that even if he got away with this now, if he kept down this path, there would come a time when it would all come crashing down. And then he might not be the next Lord Malfoy any more.
"Mr. Malfoy," said the oldest-looking boy, "why are you protecting her?" "So you've located the mistress of the conspiracy," Draco said with a number two sneer. "And it's... let me get this straight now. A first-year girl named Millicent Bulstrode. She's just a conduit, you niddlewit."
"So?" demanded the older boy. "She helped them."
Draco lifted his wand and the prismatic sphere winked out. Still, talking in a bored voice, Draco said,
"Did you know what you were doing, Miss Bulstrode?"
"No,"
Millicent stammered from where she was still sitting at her desk.
"Did you know where the Slytherin messages you were passing on were going to?"
"No,"
said Millicent.
"Thank you," said Draco. "All of you, please leave her alone. She's just a pawn. Miss Bulstrode, you may consider the favour you did me in February to have been repaid."
And Draco turned back to his potions homework, hoping to Merlin and back that Millicent didn't say anything incredibly stupid like, "What favour?"
"Then why," a voice said clearly from across the room, "did those witches go where a note from Millicent told them to go?"
Sweating even more, Draco lifted his head again to look at where Randolph Lee had spoken.
"What did the fake note say exactly?" said Draco. "Was it, 'I command you to go forth in the name of the Dark Lady Bulstrode,' or 'Please meet me here, sincerely, Millicent'?"
Randolph Lee opened his mouth, hesitated for a fractional second.
"I thought so," said Draco. "That wasn't a very good test, Mr. Lee. It can..."
A frantic, nerve-wracking moment while he figured out how to say it without using Harry's words, like false positive.
"It can get the witches to go there if any of them is just friends with Millicent."
As though the matter had been entirely settled, Draco looked down again at his potions homework, ignoring, except for the feeling of sick dread in his stomach, the whispers from around the room. It was only out of the corner of his eye that he caught Gregory staring at him. Draco's eyes rested on his astronomy homework, but he couldn't make his mind focus there. If you were trying not to think about things, Harry Potter had said, pretty much the worst possible thing you could do was look at your textbook's pictures of the night sky and try to remember what you weren't supposed to know about how the planets wandered. Astronomy, a noble and prestigious art, a sign of learning and knowledge. Only muggles possessed secret modern artifacts which could do it a million, billion times better using methods that Harry had tried to explain and which Draco still couldn't begin to understand, except that, apparently, it didn't even take magic to make things do arithmetic. Draco looked at the pictures of constellations and wondered if it was like this in the other houses, if people were always threatening each other in Ravenclaw. Harry Potter had told him once that soldiers on a battlefield didn't really fight for their country. Patriotism might get them to the battlefield in the first place, but once they were there, they fought to protect each other, the friends they'd trained with who were right in front of them. And Harry had observed, and Draco had known that it was true, that you couldn't use loyalty to a leader to power a Patronus charm. It wasn't quite the right kind of warm and happy thought. But thinking of protecting someone beside you... That, Harry Potter had said thoughtfully, was probably why the Death Eaters had fallen apart the moment the Dark Lord had departed. They hadn't been warm enough to each other. You could recruit a group that included Bellatrix Black and Amicus Carrow alongside Lord Malfoy and Mr. McNair and keep them in line with the Cruciatus Curse. But the instant the Master of the Dark Mark was gone, you didn't have any army anymore. You had a circle of acquaintances. That was why Father had failed. It hadn't even really been his fault. There'd been nothing Father could have done after inheriting Death Eaters who weren't really friends with each other. And even though it was Slytherin House he was supposed to defend, Slytherin House, which he and Harry had formed a pact to save, sometimes Draco couldn't help but think that it was just less wearisome when he was leading army practices, when he was working with students from the other three houses that weren't Slytherin. Once you saw and named the problems, you couldn't stop seeing them. It just got more annoying every day.
"Mr. Malfoy," said the voice of Gregory Goyle from where he was lying on the floor beside Draco's desk,
in a small but private bedroom. Gregory was doing his transfiguration homework, on which he often needed help. Any distraction was welcome at this point.
"Yes," said Draco. "You weren't really plotting against Granger at all," said Gregory. "Were you?"
The sensation spreading through Draco's stomach felt just like Gregory's voice sounded, sickened and afraid.
"You actually were helping Granger that day you picked her up off the floor," said Gregory. "And before, that time you kept her from falling off the roof, you helped a mudblood."
"Yeah, right," said Draco sarcastically, without the slightest hesitation or delay,
looking back down at his astronomy homework like he wasn't the least bit nervous. It was all happening the way Draco had feared it would. But at least that meant he'd played his conversation in his head over and over, coming up with the right opening gambit.
"Come on, Gregory, you've dueled General Granger. You know how strong her spells are. Like, a real muggle spawn is going to be more powerful than you, more powerful than Theodore, more powerful than every single pureblood in our whole school year, except me. Don't you actually believe in anything Father says? She's adopted. Her parents died in the war, and someone stuck her with a couple of muggles to hide her. No way is General Granger a real mudblood."
A slow pulse of silence through Draco's bedroom. Draco wanted to know, needed to know, what look was on Gregory's face. But he couldn't look up from his desk. Not yet. Not until Gregory spoke first. And then...
"Is that what Harry Potter said to you?"
said Gregory. The voice wavered and broke. When Draco looked up from his homework, he saw that tears were leaking out of Gregory's eyes. Apparently that hadn't worked.
"I don't know what to do," Gregory said in a whisper. "I don't know what to do now, Mr. Malfoy. Your father isn't... When he finds out, he's not going to like it, Mr. Malfoy."
"It's not your job to decide what Father will like, Goyle."
Draco could hear the words in his head. They sounded in Father's voice, with the same sternness. It was the sort of thing Father had told him to say. If Vincent or Gregory ever questioned him, and if that didn't work, he was to hex them. They were not equal friends, Father had said, and he wasn't ever to forget it. Draco was in charge. They were his servants, and if Draco couldn't keep it that way, then he wasn't fit to inherit House Malfoy. "It's all right, Gregory," Draco said as gently as he could. "All you've got to do is worry about protecting me. Nobody's going to blame you for following my orders. Not my father, not yours." Putting all the warmth he could into his voice, like trying to cast a Patronus charm. "And anyway, the next war isn't going to be the same as the last one. House Malfoy was around long before the Dark Lord, and not every Lord Malfoy does the same thing. Father knows that."
"Does he?" said Gregory in trembling voice. "Does he? Really?"
Draco nodded.
"Professor Quirrell knows it too," said Draco. "That's what the armies are about. The defense professor's right. When the next war comes, Father won't be able to unite the whole country. They'll remember the last war. But anyone who's fought in Professor Quirrell's armies will remember who the strongest generals were. They'll know who's worthy to lead them. They'll proclaim Harry Potter their lord, and I'll be his right hand, and House Malfoy will come out on top, like always. People might even turn to me if Potter isn't there, so long as they think I'm trustworthy. That's what I'm setting up now. Father will understand."
Gregory reached up and wiped his eyes, looking down at his transfiguration homework.
"Okay," Gregory said in a shaky voice. "If you say so, Mr. Malfoy."
Draco nodded again, ignoring the hollow feeling inside himself at the lies he'd just told his friend, and turned back to the stars.
Aftermath. Hermione Granger and...
Being invisible should have been more interesting than this. The corridors of Hogwarts should have been outlined in strange colours or something. But actually, Hermione thought, being under Harry's invisibility cloak was exactly like not being under an invisibility cloak, except for the cloak part. When you pulled the veil of soft black cloth down from the hood and over your face, you couldn't even see it stretching in front of you, and afterward it didn't seem to impede your breathing. And the world looked just the same, except that when you walked past things of metal, you didn't see any small reflections of yourself. Portraits never looked at you, only did whatever strange things they did when they were alone. Hermione hadn't tried walking past a mirror yet. She wasn't sure she wanted to. Most of all, there was no you anymore as you walked around. No hands, no feet, just a changing point of view. It was an unnerving feeling, not so much of being invisible as of not existing. Harry hadn't questioned her at all. She had just got out the word invisibility, and then Harry was drawing his invisibility cloak from his pouch. She hadn't even been given a chance to explain about her extremely secret meeting with Daphne and Millicent Bulstrode, or that she thought it would help protect the other girls. Harry had just handed over what was probably a Deathly Hallow. If you were fair, and she did try to be fair, she had to admit that sometimes Harry could be a very true, true friend. The secret meeting itself had been a great big failure. Millicent had claimed to be a seer. Hermione had carefully explained to Millicent and Daphne at considerable length that this could not possibly be true. She and Harry had looked up divination early on in their research. Harry had insisted that they read everything they could find about prophecies that wasn't in the restricted section. As Harry had observed, it would save a lot of effort if they could just get a seer to prophesy everything they would figure out 35 years later. Or, to put it in Harry terms, any means of obtaining information transmitted from the distant future was potentially an instant global victory condition. But, as Hermione had explained to Millicent, prophesying wasn't controllable. There was no way to ask for a prophecy about anything in particular. Instead, the books had said, there was a sort of pressure that built up in time when some huge event was trying to happen or stop itself from happening. And seers were like weak points that let out the pressure when the right listener was nearby. So, prophecies were only about big, important things because only that generated enough pressure. And you almost never got more than one seer saying the same thing because afterward, the pressure was gone. And, as Hermione had further explained to Millicent, the seers themselves didn't remember their prophecies because the message wasn't for them. And the messages would come out in riddles, and only someone who heard the prophecy in the seer's original voice would hear all the meaning that was in the riddle. There was no possible way that Millicent could just give out a prophecy any time she wanted about school bullies and then remember it. And if she had, it would have come out as, "The skeleton is the key," and not, "Susan Bones has to be there." Millicent had been looking rather frightened at this point, so Hermione had relaxed her fists where they'd been jammed on her hips, calmed herself down, and stated carefully that she was glad Millicent had helped them, but they had sometimes walked into traps following what Millicent said, and so Hermione really did want to know where the messages had actually come from. And Millicent had said in a small voice,
But she told me that she was a seer."
Hermione had told Daphne not to press it, after Millicent had refused to give up her source. It wasn't just that Hermione had felt awful about the scared look on Millicent's face. It was that Hermione had a strong feeling that if they did find the person who'd been telling Millicent things, why, they would turn out to just be finding envelopes under their pillow in the morning. She was getting that same despairing feeling she'd gotten in the battle before Christmas, looking at Sabini's charts with all the coloured lines and boxes and... And she really had only just now realized what it meant that Zabini had been the one showing her that chart. Even for a Ravenclaw, she felt, there was such a thing as having your life get overly complicated. Hermione began ascending a short spiral of yellow marble steps protruding from a central spine. A poorly kept, secret staircase that was actually one of the fastest ways up from the Slytherin dungeons to the Ravenclaw Tower, but which only witches could traverse. Why girls in particular needed a quick way to move from Ravenclaw to Slytherin and back was something Hermione found a bit puzzling. At the top of the staircase, now that she was away from Slytherin places and back into the main parts of Hogwarts, Hermione stopped and took off Harry's invisibility cloak. After her pouch had swallowed the cloak, Hermione turned right and started to walk down a short passageway, now automatically keeping an eye out in all directions, without really thinking about it. And her constantly scanning eyes glanced into a shadowy alcove. Fleeting disorientation. And then a rush of shock and fear hit her like a stunning hex over her whole body. She found that without any thought or any conscious decision, her wand had leapt into her hand and was already pointed at... a black cloak so wide and billowing that it was impossible to determine whether the figure beneath was male or female, and atop the cloak a broad-brimmed black hat, and a black mist seemed to gather beneath it and obscure the face of whoever or whatever might lie beneath.
"Hello again, Hermione,"
whispered a sibilant voice from beneath the black hat, from behind the black mist. Hermione's heart was already pounding hugely inside her chest. Her witch's robes felt already sweat-dampened against her skin. There was a taste of fear already in her mouth. She didn't know why she was so suddenly filled up with adrenaline, but her hand gripped harder on her wand.
"Who are you?"
Hermione demanded. The hat tilted slightly. The whispery voice, when it came forth from the black mist, sounded dry as dust.
"The last ally,"
spoke the sibilant whisper.
"The one who finally answers when no other will answer you. I am perhaps the only true friend you have in all Hogwarts, Hermione. For you have now seen how the others stayed silent when you were in need."
"What's your name?"
The black cloak rotated slightly, back and forth. It didn't look like shoulders shrugging, but it conveyed a shrug.
"That is the riddle, young Ravenclaw. Until you solve it, you may call me whatever you wish."
She could feel her palm already sweaty, and was thankful for the spiral grooves on her wand that helped her hand keep a steady grip on the wood.
"Well, Mr. Incredibly Suspicious Person,"
Hermione said,
"what do you want with me?"
"That is the wrong question," came the whisper from Black Mist. "You should ask, rather, what I can offer you."
"No,"
the young girl said quite steadily.
"I don't think I should be asking that, actually."
A high-pitched chuckle from behind the black mist.
"Not power," whispered the voice. "Not wealth. You care little for such things. Do you, young Ravenclaw? Knowledge, that is what I possess. I know what is unfolding within this school. All the hidden plans and players. The answers of the riddle. I know the true reason for the coldness you see in Harry Potter's eyes. I know the true nature of Professor Quirrell's mysterious illness. I know who Dumbledore truly fears."
"Good for you,"
said Hermione Granger.
"But do you know how many licks it takes to get to the Tootsie Roll Center of a Tootsie Pop?"
The black mist seemed to darken slightly. The voice sounded lower when it spoke. Disappointed.
"So, you're not even curious, young Ravenclaw, about the truths behind the lies."
187,
she said.
"I tried it once, and that's how many it came out to."
Her hand was almost slipping on her wand. There was a sense of fatigue in her fingers, like she'd been holding the wand for hours instead of minutes. The voice hissed.
"Professor Snape is a hidden Death Eater. Hermione almost dropped her wand. The voice whispered in satisfaction. I thought that might interest you. So, Hermione, is there anything else you would like to know about your enemies? Or those you call friends? She stared up at the black mist that topped the towering black cloak, frantically trying to order her thoughts. Professor Snape was a Death Eater? Who would tell her something like that? Why? What was going on?
That's...
Hermione said. Her voice was quavering.
That's extremely serious business, if it's really true. Why are you telling something like that to me, and not to Headmaster Dumbledore?
Dumbledore did nothing to stop Snape, the Black Mist whispered. You saw it, Hermione. The rot at Hogwarts begins at the top. Everything that is wrong with this school, it all begins with the mad headmaster. You alone dared to call him out for it, and therefore I speak to you.
And have you also spoken to Harry Potter, then?
Hermione said, keeping her voice as even as she could. If this was his helpful ghost. The black mist darkened and lightened, like a shake of the head. I am frightened of Harry Potter, it whispered. Of the coldness in his eyes, of the darkness that grows behind them. Harry Potter is a killer, and anyone who is an obstacle to him will die. Even you, Hermione Granger, if you dare truly oppose him, the darkness behind his eyes will reach out and destroy you. This I know.
Then you don't know the half of what you pretend to know,
Hermione said, her voice a little firmer.
I'm scared of Harry too, but not because of what he might ever do to me. I'm scared of what he might do to protect me.
Wrong. The whisper was flat and hard, as if to brook no possibility of denial. Harry Potter will turn against you in time, Hermione, when the darkness takes him fully. He will not shed a tear. He will not even notice on the day his footsteps finally crush you underneath.
Double wrong!
She said back in a rising voice, even though there were chills going down her spine. One of Harry's phrases came to her.
Just what do you think you know? And how do you think you know it anyway?
Time. The voice seemed to catch itself. Time enough for that later. For now. For today. Indeed, Harry Potter is not your enemy, and yet you are in gravest danger.
I can believe that,
said Hermione Granger. She desperately wanted to shift her wand to her other hand. She felt like she had to grab her right arm just to keep it up. Her head ached like she had been staring at the black mist for days. She didn't know why she'd gotten tired so quickly. Lucius Malfoy has taken notice of you, Hermione. The whisper had risen,
departed from its tonelessness, taken on a note of audible concern.
"You have humiliated Slytherin House. You have defeated his son in battle. Even before then, you were an embarrassment to all who stand with the Death Eaters. For you are a Muggle-born, and yet you possess a power of wizardry greater than any pure blood. And now you are becoming known, the eyes of the world on you. Lucius Malfoy seeks to crush you, Hermione, to hurt you, and perhaps even kill you. And he has the means to do it."
The whisper had grown urgent. There was a pause.
"Is that all?"
Hermione said. If she was ex-Colonel Zabini or Harry Potter, she'd probably be asking clever questions to gather more information. But her mind felt slow and fatigued. She really needed to get out of here and go lie down for a while.
"You don't believe me,"
the whisper said, softer and sadder now.
"Why not, Hermione? I am trying to help you."
Hermione took a step backward, away from the shadowy alcove.
"Why not, Hermione?"
demanded the voice, rising to a hiss.
"You owe me that much. Tell me, and then—"
The voice caught and came back quieter.
"And then you can go, I suppose. Only tell me why."
Maybe she shouldn't have answered. Maybe she should have just turned and fled, or better yet, cast a prismatic wall first, and then screamed at the top of her lungs as she ran. But it was the note of real pain in the voice that caught her. And so she answered,
"Because you look incredibly dark, and scary, and suspicious,"
Hermione said, keeping her voice polite as her wand stayed level on the towering black cloak and the faceless black mist.
"That's all?"
whispered the voice incredulously. Sadness seemed to infuse it.
"I hoped for better from you, Hermione. Surely such a Ravenclaw as you, the most intelligent Ravenclaw to grace Hogwarts in a generation, knows that appearances can be misleading."
"Oh, I know it," said Hermione.
She took another step back, her tired fingers tightening on the wand.
"But the thing that people forget sometimes is that even though appearances can be misleading, they're usually not."
There was a pause.
"You are the clever one,"
said the voice, and the black mist evaporated away, no longer obscuring. She saw the face beneath, and recognition sent a jolt of terrified adrenaline bursting through her. Fleeting disorientation, and then a rush of shock and fear hit her like a stunning hex over her whole body. She found that without any thought or any conscious decision, her wand had leapt into her hand and was already pointed at a shining lady, her long white dress billowing about her as though in invisible winds. Neither her hands nor her feet were visible, her face hidden beneath a white veil, and she was glowing all over. Not like a ghost, not transparent, just surrounded by soft white light. Hermione stared open-mouthed at the gentle sight, wondering why her heart was already hammering and why she felt so scared.
"Hello again, Hermione."
The kindly whisper emanated from the white glow behind the veil.
"I've been sent to help you,
so please don't be afraid. I am your servant in all things, for you, my lady, are the bearer of a most marvellous destiny."
Chapter 78. Taboo Trade-Off's Prelude. Cheating. It was Saturday, on the 4th of April, in the year 1992. Mr. and Mrs. Davis looked rather nervous as they sat in a certain special section of the Hogwarts Quidditch stands, though today the cushioned benches did not look upon flying broomsticks, but rather viewed a gigantic square of something like parchment. A great white blankness, soon to flicker with windows into grass and soldiers. For now, it showed only the reflected dull grey colour of the surrounding overcast skies, looking rather stormy, though the weather wizards had promised that the rain wouldn't break before nightfall. Ordinarily, it was the ancient tradition of Hogwarts that mere parents were to stay out, for much the same reason that impatient children are told to get out of the kitchen and not meddle in the cook's affairs. The only reason for a parent-teacher conference was if a teacher felt that a parent wasn't shaping up properly. It took an exceptional circumstance to make the Hogwarts administration feel that it had to justify itself to you. On any given occasion, generally speaking, the Hogwarts administration was backed up by 800 years of distinguished history, and you were not. Thus, it had been with some trepidation that Mr. and Mrs. Davis had insisted on an audience with Deputy Headmistress McGonagall. It was hard to muster a proper sense of indignation when you were confronting the same dignified witch who, 12 years and 4 months earlier, had given both of you 2 weeks' detention after catching you in the act of conceiving Tracy. On the other hand, Mr. and Mrs. Davis's courage had been helped by angrily waving about a copy of The Quibbler, whose headline showed in bright bold text for all the world to see,
"Pacts with Potter, Bones Davis Granger, in Love Rectangle of Fear."
And so, Mr. and Mrs. Davis had argued their way into the faculty box of the Hogwarts Quidditch stands, where they were now ensconced with an excellent view of Professor Quirrell's enchanted screens, so that the two of them could see for themselves
"Just what the fiddly snarks has been going on in this school, if you'll pardon the expression, Deputy Headmistress McGonagall."
Seated to the left of Mr. Davis was another concerned parent, a white-haired man in elegant black robes of unmatchable quality, one Lucius Malfoy, political leader of the strongest faction of the Wizengamot. To the left of Lord Malfoy, a sneeringly aristocratic man with a scarred face who had been introduced to them as Lord Jugson. Then, an elderly but sharp-eyed fellow named Charles Knott, rumoured to be nearly as wealthy as Lord Malfoy, seated on Lord Jugson's left. On the right of Mrs. Davis, one would find the comely lady, and yet handsomer lord of the noble and most ancient house of Greengrass. Young they were, as wizards counted age, garbed in grey silken robes set with tiny dark emeralds embroidered into the shape of grass blades. The Lady Greengrass was considered a key swing vote on the Wizengamot, her own mother having retired from the body with surprising speed. Her charming husband, though his family was not noble or wealthy of itself, had taken a seat on the Hogwarts Board of Governors. To their right, a square-jawed and incredibly tough-looking old witch, who had shaken hands with Mr. and Mrs. Davis without the slightest hint of condescension. This was Amelia Bones, Director of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement. to Amelia's right, was a seniorish woman who had set the fashion scene of magical Britain on its ear by integrating a live vulture into her hat, one Augusta Longbottom. Though she was not addressed as Lady, Madam Longbottom would exercise the full rights of the Longbottom family for so long as their last scion had yet to attain his majority, and she was considered a prominent figure in a minority faction of the Wizengamot. At the side of Madam Longbottom was seated none other than the Chief Warlock Supreme Mugwump, Headmaster Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, legendary defeater of Grindelwald, protector of Britain, rediscoverer of the fabled 12 uses of dragon's blood, the most powerful wizard in the world. And finally, on the far right, one would find the enigmatic defense professor of Hogwarts, Quirinus Quirrell, who was leaning back on the cushioned benches as though resting, seeming entirely and naturally at ease in the rarefied company of a voting quorum of the Hogwarts Board of Governors, which had dropped by on this fine Saturday to learn just what the fiddly snocks had been going on at Hogwarts in general, and with Draco Malfoy, Theodore Knott, Daphne Greengrass, Susan Bones, and Neville Longbottom in particular. The name of Harry Potter had also been much discussed. Oh, and one mustn't forget Tracy Davis, of course. Director Bones's eyebrows had climbed in some interest upon hearing the young couple introduced as her parents. Lord Jugson had given them a brief, incredulous stare before dismissing them with a snort. Lucius Malfoy had greeted them politely, his smile containing a hint of grim amusement, mixed with pity. Mr. and Mrs. Davis, whose last vote on anything of significance had been touching their wands to the name of Minister Fudge, who had all of 300 galleons stored in their Gringotts vault, and who respectively worked at selling cauldrons in a potion shop and enchanting omnoculars, were pressed up tightly against each other, sitting rigidly erect upon their cushioned benches, and desperately wishing they'd worn nicer robes. The sky above was a solid mass of cloud, dispersed into darker and lighter greys, grim with the promise of future storms, though no lightning flickered as yet, nor distant rumbles of thunder echoed, and only a few threatening droplets had fallen. To their designated starting place in a certain forest, the Sunshine Regiment marched, though it was really more like a slow walk. You wouldn't want to tire yourself out before the battle even started, and the breezes of April were annoyingly humid, though cool. Ahead of them, a yellow flame wandered slowly through the air, guiding them according to their pace. Susan Bones kept throwing worried glances toward the Sunshine General as they marched through the greyly illuminated forest. Professor Snape's going after Hermione seemed to have really shaken her. Hermione had even missed her Sunshine Regiment official planning meeting, which seemed understandable enough. But when Susan had offered her sympathy afterward, Hermione had stammered that she'd lost track of time, which wasn't at all a usual thing for her to say, and the girl had looked exhausted and frightened, like she'd just spent 3 days locked in a bathroom stall with a dementor. Even now, when all the Sunshine General's focus should have been on the coming battle, the Ravenclaw girl's gaze was constantly darting in all directions, as though she expected dark wizards to jump out of the bushes and sacrifice her.
"The ban on Muggle artifacts cuts down our options a lot,"
Anthony Goldstein was saying in the dour tones the boy used to denote deliberate pessimism.
"I had the idea of trying to transfigure nets to throw on people, but no good.
said Ernie Macmillan. The Hufflepuff boy shook his head, looking even more serious than Antony.
I mean, it's just like throwing a hex. They're dodge.
Antony nodded.
That's what I figured too. Do you have any ideas, Seamus?
The former chaotic lieutenant still looked a bit nervous and out of place, marching along with his new comrades in the Sunshine Regiment.
Sorry, said the newly minted Captain Finnegan.
I'm more the strategic master type.
I'm the strategic master type, said Ron Weasley, sounding put off.
There are three armies,
the Sunshine General said acerbically,
which means we fight two armies at once, which means we need more than one strategist, which means shut up, Ron!
Ron gave their general a surprised and worried look.
Hey,
the Gryffindor boy said in a calming tone,
you shouldn't let Snape get to you so much.
What do you think we ought to do, General?
Susan said very loudly and quickly.
I mean, we don't really have a plan at this point.
Their official planning session had failed amazingly, with Hermione gone and both Ron and Antony thinking they were in charge.
Do we really need a plan?
The Sunshine General said, sounding a little distracted.
We've got you, and me, and Lavender, and Parvati, and Hannah, and Daphne, and Ron, and Ernie, and Antony, and Captain Finnegan.
That, began Antony, sounds like a pretty good strategy,
Ron said with an approving nod.
We've got as many strong soldiers now as both other armies put together. Chaos has only got Potter and Longbottom, and Knot left. Well, and Zabini too, I suppose.
And Tracy,
said Hermione. Several people swallowed nervously.
Oh, stop it,
Susan said sharply.
She's just a battle-hardened member of Spew. That's all General Sunshine means.
Still, Ernie said, turning to look seriously at Susan,
I think you'd better go with whatever group fights chaos, Captain Bones. I know you can't use your double magical powers except when innocents are in danger, but I mean, just in case Miss Davis does, you know, go out of control and try to eat someone's soul.
I can handle her,
Susan told him, keeping her voice reassuring. Admittedly, Susan hadn't been replaced by a Metamorphagus at the moment, but then Tracy probably wasn't Polyjuiced Dumbledore or whoever. Captain Finnegan intoned in a deep, sort of rumbling voice,
I find your lack of scepticism disturbing.
He raised his hand with his thumb and forefinger almost touching, pointed at Ernie. For some reason, Antony Goldstein seemed to have a sudden choking fit.
What's that supposed to mean?
Said Ernie.
It's just something General Potter says sometimes, said Captain Finnegan. Funny, when you first joined the Chaos Legion, it all seems crazy. And then, after a couple of months, you realise that actually everyone who isn't in the Chaos Legion is crazy.
I said, Ron said loudly, it sounds like good strategy. We don't transfigure anything. We don't tire ourselves out. We handle whatever they throw at us, and then we just overrun them.
Okay, said Hermione. Let's do that. But,
said Antony, shooting a glare at Ron.
But, General, Harry Potter's got 16 people left in his army. Dragon and us each have 28. Harry knows that. He knows he's got to come up with something incredible. Like what?
Demanded Hermione, sounding stressed.
If we don't know what he's planning, we might as well save our magic for doing Mast Finites, like we should have done last time.
Susan touched Hermione gently on the shoulder.
General Granger,
said Susan.
"I think you should take a break for a bit before the battle."
She'd been expecting Hermione to argue, but Hermione just nodded and then walked a little faster, pulling away from the Sunshine Regiment official officer group, her eyes still watching the forest, and sometimes the sky. Susan followed her. It wouldn't do having it look like the Sunshine General was being ejected from her own official officer group.
"Hermione?"
Susan said softly after they walked a bit away.
"You've got to focus. Professor Quirrell's in charge here, not Snape, and he won't let anything bad happen to you or anyone." "You're not helping,"
Hermione said, sounding shaky.
"You're not helping at all, Captain Bones."
The two of them walked faster, circling around some of the other soldiers, inspecting the marching perimeter and glancing at the surrounding trees.
"Susan?"
Hermione said in a small voice when they'd gotten further away from all the others.
"Do you think Daphne's right about Draco Malfoy plotting something?"
"Yes,"
Susan said at once, not even thinking about it.
"You can tell because his name's got the letters M-A-L-F-O and Y in it."
Hermione looked around, as if to make sure that nobody was watching, although of course that was a wonderful way to get other people to pay attention to you.
"Could Malfoy have been behind what Snape did?"
"Snape could be behind Malfoy,"
Susan said thoughtfully, remembering dinner table conversations she'd heard at Auntie's.
"Or Lucius Malfoy could be behind both of them."
A slight chill went down Susan's spine as this last thought occurred to her. Suddenly, telling Hermione to just focus on the coming battle seemed a lot less reasonable.
"Why, did you find some sort of clue about that?"
Hermione shook her head.
"No,"
the Ravenclaw girl said in a voice that sounded almost like she was about to cry.
"I was just thinking about it myself. That's all."
In their designated place in a forest near Hogwarts, the Dragon General and the warriors of Dragon Army waited where their red flame had led them, beneath grey skies. At Draco's side stood Padma Patil, his second in command, who had once led all of Dragon Army after Draco had been stunned. At Draco's back was Vincent, the son of Crab, a family which had served the Malfoys into the distance of forgotten memory. The muscular boy was watchful as he was always watchful, whether battle had been declared or no. Further back, Gregory of the Goyles stood waiting beside one of the two broomsticks Dragon Army had been given. If the Goyles had not served the Malfoys so long as the Crabs, yet they had served no less well. And at Draco's left side now stood one Dean Thomas of Gryffindor, a mudblood, or possible half-blood, who knew nothing of his father. Sending Dean Thomas to Dragon Army had been a quite deliberate move on Harry's part, Draco was certain. Three other former Chaotics had also been transferred to Dragon Army, and all were watching Draco hawk-like to see if he offered the former lieutenant the slightest insult. Some might have called it sabotage, but Draco knew better. Harry had also sent Lieutenant Finnegan to the Sunshine Regiment, even though Professor Quirrell's mandate had only required that Harry give up one lieutenant. That, too, had been a deliberate move, making crystal clear to everyone that Harry wasn't dumping his least favourite soldiers. In one sense, it might have been easier for Draco to win the true loyalties of his new soldiers if they'd thought Harry hadn't wanted them. In another sense, well, it wasn't easy to put into words. Harry had given him good soldiers with their pride intact, but it was more than that. Harry had showed kindliness toward his soldiers, but it was more than that. It wasn't just Harry playing fair. It was something that... that you couldn't help but contrast with the way the game was played in Slytherin House. So, Draco hadn't offered the slightest insult to Mr. Thomas, but brought him straight to his side, subordinate to himself and Padma, but no one else. It was a test, Draco had told Mr. Thomas and everyone, not a promotion. Mr. Thomas would have to show himself worthy of rank within Dragon Army, but he would be given a chance, and the chance would be fair. Mr. Thomas had looked surprised at the ceremony of it. The Chaos Legion, from what Draco had heard, didn't stand on formality, but the Gryffindor boy had stood a little straighter and nodded. And then, after Mr. Thomas had done well enough in one of Dragon Army's training sessions, he'd been brought into the strategy session in Dragon Army's huge military office. And a few minutes into the session, Padma had happened to ask, as though it was a perfectly normal question, whether Mr. Thomas had any ideas about how to defeat the Chaos Legion. The Gryffindor boy had said cheerfully that Harry had predicted that General Malfoy would get one of his soldiers to ask him that, and that Harry had given him the message that General Malfoy should ask himself where his relative advantage lay. What Draco Malfoy could do, or what Dragon Army could do, that Chaos Legion couldn't match, and then try to exploit it for all its worth. Dean Thomas couldn't think of what that advantage might be, but if he did come up with any ideas for beating Chaos, he'd share them. Harry had ordered him to, after all. Sigh, Draco had thought, since he couldn't actually sigh out loud. But it was good advice, and Draco had followed it, sitting at his bedroom desk with quill and parchment, listing out everything that might be a relative advantage. And, almost to Draco's own surprise, he had an idea. A real one. In fact, he'd had two. The hollow bell sounded through the forest, somehow sounding more ominous than ever before. On the instant, the two pilots cried, "Up!" and leapt onto their broomsticks, heading into the grey sky. Mr. and Mrs. Davis had now slumped slightly against each other, more from sheer muscle exhaustion than from any decrease of tension. Before them, the vast blank white parchment flickered with three great windows, as though holes had been cut through into the forest, showing three armies on the march. Lesser windows showed the six riders upon their broomsticks, and the corner of the parchment showed a view of the entire forest, with glowing dots to indicate armies and scouts. The window into Sunshine showed General Granger and her captains marching in the centre of the Sunshine Regiment, protected by Contago screens along with a number of other young witches. The Sunshine Regiment, the defence professor had remarked, knew well that it had now acquired a strong advantage in experienced soldiers, and it meant to protect those soldiers from a surprise attack. Aside from that, the Sunshine soldiers were moving forward at a steady march, conserving their strength. The soldiers in General Malfoy's army, at least those with higher transfiguration scores, were picking up leaves and transfiguring them into... well, if you looked at Padma Patil, who was almost done with hers, it looked like her leaf was becoming a left-handed glove bearing a dangling strap. The window had zoomed in to show this. Lord Jugson was watching the screen with a flat expression. His voice, when he spoke, seemed to ooze and drip with disdain.
"What is your son doing, Lucius?"
The foreign-born witch, who stood at Draco Malfoy's side, had finished transfiguring her glove,
and was now bringing it before the Dragon General like a sacrifice.
"I do not know,"
said Lucius Malfoy, his tone calm, though no less aristocratic.
"But I must trust that he has good reason for doing it."
All Dragon Army stopped for a moment as Padma slid the glove over her left hand, strapped it in place, and presented it before Draco Malfoy, who also stopped in place, took several deep breaths, raised his wand, executed a precise set of 8 movements, and bellowed,
"Coloportus!"
The dragon warrior raised her gloved hand, flexed it, and gave a small bow to Draco Malfoy, who returned it more shallowly, though the Dragon General was staggering slightly. Padma then returned to her place at Draco's side, and the dragons began marching once more.
"Well," remarked Augusta Longbottom, "I don't suppose someone would care to explain?"
Amelia Bones was frowning slightly as she gazed at the screen.
"For some reason or other," said the amused voice of Professor Quirrell, "it seems that the Scion of Malfoy is able to cast surprisingly strong magic for a first-year student, due to the purity of his blood, of course. Certainly, the good Lord Malfoy would not have openly flouted the underage magic laws by arranging for his son to receive a wand before his acceptance into Hogwarts."
"I suggest you be careful in your implications, Quirrell,"
Lucius Malfoy said coldly.
"Oh, I am," Professor Quirrell said. "A coloportus cannot be dispelled by finite incantatum. It requires an alohomora of equal strength. Until then, a glove so charmed will resist lesser material forces, deflect the sleep hex and the stunning hex. And as neither Mr. Potter nor Miss Granger can cast a counterspell powerful enough, that charm is invincible upon this battlefield. It is not the original intent of the charm, nor the intent of whoever taught Mr. Malfoy an emergency spell for evading his enemies, but it would seem that Mr. Malfoy has been learning creativity."
Lucius Malfoy had straightened as the defense professor spoke. He now sat erect upon his cushioned bench, his head held perceptibly higher than before, and when he spoke it was with quiet pride.
"He will be the greatest Lord Malfoy that has yet lived."
"Faint praise,"
Augusta Longbottom said under her breath. Amelia Bones chuckled, as did Mr. Davis for a tiny, fatal fraction of a second before he stopped with a strangled gargle.
"I quite agree," said Professor Quirrell, though it wasn't clear to whom he spoke. "Unfortunately for Mr. Malfoy, he is still new to the art of creativity, and so he has committed a classic error of Ravenclaw."
"And what might that be?"
said Lucius Malfoy, his voice now turned chill once more. Professor Quirrell had leaned back in his seat, the pale blue eyes briefly unfocusing as one of the windows shifted its viewpoint within the greater screen, zooming in to show the sweat now on Draco Malfoy's forehead.
"It is such a beautiful idea that Mr. Malfoy has quite overlooked its pragmatic difficulties."
"Would someone care to explain that?"
said Lady Greengrass.
"Not all of us present are experts at such affairs."
Amelia Bones spoke, the old witch's voice somewhat dry.
It will tempt them to try to catch hexes that they would be wiser to simply dodge. The more so if they have had little practice catching them, and the casting of so many charms will tire their strongest warrior.
Professor Quirrell gave the DMLE director a half nod of acknowledgement.
As you say, Madam Bones, Mr. Malfoy is new to the business of having ideas, and so when he has one, he becomes proud of himself for having it. He has not yet had enough ideas to unflinchingly discard those that are beautiful in some aspects and impractical in others. He has not yet acquired confidence in his own ability to think of better ideas as he requires them. What we are seeing here is not Mr. Malfoy's best idea, I fear, but rather his only idea.
Lord Malfoy simply turned to watch the screens again, as though the defense professor had used up his right to exist.
But, said Lord Greengrass, but what in Merlin's name is Harry Potter?
16 remaining soldiers of the Chaos Legion, or 15 plus Blaze Zabini, rather, marched confidently through the forest, their shoes thudding over the still dry ground. Their camouflaged uniforms blended into the forest even more than usual, all colours washed out by the tints of an overcast day. 16 Chaos Legionnaires against 28 Dragon Warriors and 28 Sunshine Soldiers. The common consensus had been that, with odds that bad, it was practically impossible for them to lose. After all, General Chaos was bound to come up with something really spectacular facing odds like that. There was something almost nightmarish about how everyone seemed to now expect Harry to pull miracles out of his hat on demand, any time one was needed. It meant that if you couldn't do the impossible, you were disappointing your friends and failing to live up to your potential. Harry hadn't bothered complaining to Professor Quirrell about too much pressure. Harry's mental model of the defense professor had predicted him looking severely annoyed, saying things along the lines of,
"You are perfectly capable of solving this problem, Mr. Potter. Did you even try?"
And then deducting several hundred Quirrell points. From above, from where two broomsticks watched their march, the high young voice of Tess Walsh cried,
"Friend!"
And after another moment,
"Gingersnap!"
A handful of seconds later, the soldier who'd codenamed herself Gingersnap returned bearing a double handful of acorns, sweating slightly in the cold but humid air from the jog that had taken her to the oak tree Neville had spotted. Gingersnap approached to where Shannon was holding a uniform skirt, with the neck tied off, in lieu of anyone having to transfigure a bag. When Gingersnap brought her hands forward to try and dump her acorns into the holding shirt, chaotic Shannon, giggling, jerked the shirt to the right, then to the left again as Gingersnap made another effort to dump the acorns until a sharp,
"Miss Friedman!"
from Lieutenant Knott caused Shannon to sigh and hold the shirt still. Gingersnap dumped her acorns into those accumulated, and then headed out for more. Somewhere in the background, Ellie Knight was singing her very own version of the Chaos Legion's marching song, and around half the other soldiers were trying to step along with it despite not knowing the tune in advance. Nearby, Nita Burdine, who had a high transfiguration score, finished creating yet another pair of green sunglasses and handed them to Adam Beringer, who folded up the sunglasses before tucking them into his uniform pocket. Other soldiers were already wearing their own green sunglasses despite the cloudy day.
you might guess that there was some sort of incredibly complicated and fascinating explanation behind this, and you would be right. 2 days earlier, Harry had been sitting amid his bookcases in the comfy rocking chair he'd obtained for his trunk's cavern level, pondering silently in the quiet span between classes and dinner time, thinking about power. For 16 chaotics to defeat 28 sunnies and 28 dragons, they would need a force amplifier. There were limits to what you could do with maneuver. There had to be a secret weapon, and it had to be invincible, or at least moderately unstoppable. Muggle artifacts were now illegal in Hogwarts mock battles, banned by Ministry edict. And the trouble with finding some other clever and unusual spell was that any army twice your own size could bruise fort finite almost anything you tried. The Sunshine Regiment might have missed that tactic with the transfigured chainmail, but nobody would miss it again now that Professor Quirrell had pointed it out. And Finite Incantatum was a brute force counterspell which required at least as much magic as the spell being cancelled, which, if you were severely outnumbered, made a whole new order of military challenge. The enemy could finite anything you tried, and still have enough magic left over for shields and volleys of sleepexes. Unless, somehow, you could invoke potencies beyond the ordinary strength of first-year Hogwarts students. Something too powerful for the enemy to finite. So, Harry had asked Neville if he had ever heard of any small, safe sacrificial rituals. And then, after the screaming and the shouting had subsided, after Harry had stopped trying to argue about unbreakable vows and just given up on the whole thing as impossible from a public relations standpoint, Harry had realized that he hadn't even needed to go there. They taught you how to invoke potencies far beyond your own strength in ordinary Hogwarts classes. Sometimes, even though you were looking straight at something, you didn't realize what you were looking at until you happened to ask exactly the right question. Defense, charms, transfiguration, potions, history of magic, astronomy, broomstick flying, herbology.
"Foe!"
screamed the voice from above. It was a good thing that Neville Longbottom hadn't the tiniest idea that his grandmother was watching, or he would have been more self-conscious about screaming scary battle cries at the top of his lungs while casting Luminos every 3 seconds as he rocketed through a dense forest of trees, hot on the tail of Gregory Goyle.
"But,"
Augusta Longbottom said, her expression showing almost as much astonishment as worry.
"But Neville is afraid of heights."
"Not all fears last," said Amelia Bones. The old witch was favouring the great screen before them with a measuring gaze.
"Or perhaps he has found courage. It is much the same in the end."
A glimmer of red. Neville dodged very nearly into a tree, but he did dodge, and then Neville somehow also managed to dodge almost all of the branches before they smacked him in the face. Now Mr. Goyle's broomstick was pulling further and further away, even though the two of them were riding exactly the same broomstick and Mr. Goyle weighed more. Somehow Neville was still falling behind. So Neville slowed down, pulled back, angled up out of the forest and began to accelerate back toward where the Chaos Legion still marched. 20 seconds later, it hadn't been a long chase, just an exciting one, Neville was back among his fellow chaotics and dismounted his broom to walk on the ground for a little bit.
"Neville," said General Potter. Harry's voice was a little distant as he walked carefully and steadily through the forest, his wand still applied to the almost finished form of the object he was slowly transfiguring. Beside him, Blaise Zabini, working a smaller version of the same transfiguration, looked like a shambling in fury as he stumbled forward. "I told you. Neville, you don't have to..." "Yes, I do," said Neville.
He looked down at where his fingers grasped the broomstick and saw that not just his hands, but his whole arms were shaking. But unless anyone else in Chaos had been practicing dueling for an hour a day with Mr. Diggory, and then practicing their aim in private for another hour afterward, Neville was probably the best shot from a broomstick, even after taking into account that he wasn't a very good flyer.
"Good show, Neville," Theodore said from where he was walking ahead of them all, leading the Chaos Legion forward through the forest while wearing only his undershirt.
Augusta Longbottom and Charles Knott exchanged brief, astonished glances and then wrenched their gazes away from one another as though stung. Neville took a few deep breaths, trying to steady his hands, trying to think. Harry might not be good for deep strategic thinking while he was in the middle of an extended transfiguration.
"Lieutenant Knott, do you have any idea why Dragon Army just did that? They lost a broom."
The dragons had started the combat with a feint to provide a distraction for Mr. Goyle's approach through the forest. Neville hadn't realized there were two brooms attacking